Okay, so what are, you can call out, what are a few of those places that, what are some of the different kinds of farms or gardens?
Iowa cornfield.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those.
Minnesota dairy farm.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those too.
Southern Illinois dairy farm.
Cow and calf operation in Louisiana.
Master Gardener. Hope Garden in Nebraska.
Jove Garden, Seattle.
Skagit Valley Organic Vegetable Garden.
Eastern Washington Apple Orchard.
Yeah.
Organic.
Vegetable garden on a college campus?
Yeah.
Cool. 10,000 acre wheat farm in Saskatchewan.
Burchard or Butchard Garden?
Oh, yeah. Is it like...
Yes.
You know what? I used to... I hated spelling... Butchard Gardens in Needs with T. But
Victoria.
Over here?
Yeah,
yeah.
Victoria.
Victoria, BC.
I would try to get... I would purposely misspell things to get out of spelling bees in grade school. I didn't like the pressure, and now my job is like spelling things in front of people all day long. But it's all right. I'm getting over it, so it's okay. It's like another 10 years or so. I should be mostly there. Master Gardener class. I missed that, getting that one written. Not class, but Master Gardener Gardens. And that's in Nebraska. Cool.
Small grain farm in northern Minnesota.
Oh, great.
Nice.
Wow, what a great list. Yeah.
Small grain.
And small, oh, small grain. Small, sorry. Small grains like, are we?
Oats and
wheat. Oats, barley.
Oats, barley. Reason I start with this is because I think that our connection to agriculture and to the food system, this whole network from seed to soil to processing to market to our plates, whether it's at home or in a restaurant or the dining hall, right? Our connection to that system needs to be rooted in the places and the people we know. So knowing these places, I think, is really important for us to help remember. It's like bringing that specificity because it's been so easy to be disconnected to where our food comes from. You know, it's me just as much as anybody, right? So in my bag I have fig bars that are my emergency fig bars for when we hit, I have a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old, and we hit like this 4 o'clock melt time where we need to get somewhere, but people are apparently going to pass out or fatally harm each other if they don't have some kind of sustenance, right? And I didn't pick the figs. I didn't grind the figs at home. I didn't raise the wheat. I didn't process the wheat. These are things I bought that are packaged that I can hand them to the, I can basically throw into the back seat and it's going to quell something for a minute or two till they tell me they don't like that flavor or whatever the problem is. But right, but it's like I'm as much in this food system as anybody. And so it's knowing kind of these kind of places, like really coming back to rooting ourselves in these places and the people in these places, I think that helps us really think critically about the system. And that it's this visceral connection to farms and gardens that will help us think about changing them and what we need to do. So I love farms and gardens. I am immensely happy. I'm the kind of person who I'm going to drag my daughters pretty soon. When we head back to California, we're going to be in Ashland for a couple days, and I think day two is going to be a farm tour because there's little farm tour maps, and so I think we're already where that's where we got to go on a farm tour. So I'm that kind of person. I grew up just outside of Spokane. Here's Washington, right? So I'm from Eastern Washington, from right there. We had the houses on our street were all about a half acre, and the we had chickens on our property. People had large gardens. We also had our house had fruit trees and some really small fruits like currants, as well as the larger fruit trees. We about two blocks away there were wheat fields, and sometimes we'd walk out to the wheat fields and pick some little bits of wheat. But we didn't really interact with the wheat farmers either. They would just basically be out there at planting and harvest primarily. And in the summer, then too nearby, we would go up into right up near Mount Spokane. There are orchards, and we'd go pick fruit. We'd go pick cherries, we'd go pick peaches, and we'd go pick raspberries. I would tip over a flat of raspberries every year. That was one of my jobs, usually just after we'd paid for them. And then we'd make jam, make lots and lots of jam and other preserves. And in high school, I went back up there and I worked in the fall at one of the apple orchards. One of my really fond memories is it was a U-pick orchard, so after the people had come through and picked, there were a couple of days that we were out finishing clearing the trees, and it was starting to snow. It was November, so there was a really light snow, and the church bells were ringing across these hills, and we were out picking these apples in the orchard. It was just so beautiful, right? I just loved that place. And then I was really involved with the Lutheran youth in the Eastern Washington, Idaho Synod, and I ended up starting to go to hunger and justice events, and really this really deep interest in hunger and justice and how those intersected was really sparked and really growing in me then. And then I went to PLU, so Pacific Lutheran University, right? And I majored in biology, and I didn't think so much about food for a while. And after I finished, there were two things that happened. One thing that happened was I was at a talk, and I was working at PLU in the communications department, and I got an afternoon off to go to a session that my friend had recommended to me. And I heard Peter Rosset from this think tank, Food First. He said the word agroecology for the first time. So I'll even write it up there. Agroecology. And it was one of those moments, it was like sunlight poured down into the lower part of the university center where we were, and I was like, that is it. That is the word that I have been looking for. This takes my interest in hunger and justice, and then all the biology and ecology classes that I took, and it just makes them into one thing. That was the moment I knew that I wanted to do that. And then another really important thing that happened was right after I graduated, a friend of mine ended up working at an urban garden in downtown Tacoma. And it was run in association with the Catholic Worker House. And seeing Carrie Little, who managed, it wasn't just one garden, it was all these little patches of gardens that she had going. And when somebody wouldn't let her turn this old lot, she would throw flower seeds over the fence and turn it into flowers because she didn't want it to just sit there doing nothing. So I saw what urban gardens were like and what that potential was. And so before too long, we ended up in Ames, Iowa for me to do my master's degree. And I studied prairie restoration, but then I also, on the side, you guys covered like, basically, by the way, you outlined like my whole, like everything in this piece, but we'll be walking through this bit by bit. But I got to see those Iowa cornfields, and I hung out with the Practical Farmers of Iowa and the Iowa Network for Community Agriculture. Two different groups, but both of them made up of people who were really looking for alternatives, and not just people, really farmers who were looking for alternatives and how to support each other in this really this landscape that's really all about large-scale corn and soybean production, right? And so there just some amazing individuals in those two groups. And so I got to know about large-scale production. I got to know about farmers in the system and the landscape of the prairie and why the prairie is such a great place to grow this giant grass we call corn and these soybeans. So the prairies, the native prairies, the ones I was doing my research on, I know from my research they grow giant grass, and there are also legumes in the prairie systems too. So we're just basically, we've reduced the diversity by a lot, but we're doing a lot of the same thing. in this environment that really supports that. And then I learned about the challenges both for conventional farmers and the system that they are in, and it's hard to change out of, and for the people who are trying alternatives. It's hard on both ends, right? And then we moved to Santa Cruz because that's where the author of the textbook that's called Agroecology was, and I wanted to go to that school to get my PhD. And I got to know the farmers there in California, which are a whole other group of farmers. And they are really, that's where the partly where the organic movement got a big push forward, because there was this real concentration of some key people at that time and place in right actually around Santa Cruz. And where certification, the road to certifying organic agriculture, where that got its push. And I got to see the cool coastal climate. And so going from corn and soybeans to things like lettuce and strawberries and broccoli and spinach, things that don't want too much heat and will grow happily. By the way, so if you decide that you're going to become a locavore and eat only local foods, Santa Cruz is a great place, because you've got strawberries from about late February. Maybe you have to wait till early March. This year was like, we had to wait probably till the end of March. We were really sad, poor Santa Cruzans. So from March to like November. So just strawberries alone over that period, right? And then everything else under the sun. So yeah, if you hear people from California talk about the importance of being a locavore, you can just remind them that it's different in different places. Santa Cruz being one of those really fine places to be a locavore. And then I did research on our campus farm. So on these marine terraces in Santa Cruz, you can see 5 marine terraces. And so the landscape is shaped by where there was both uplift of the land and then both carving back by the ocean. And then as the ocean was receding from the land. So there are kind of a couple processes going on at the same time. So these terraces, our farm at UCSC is on one of those terraces. It's immensely beautiful. Working at the farm, you have this view out over Monterey Bay with Monterey and Carmel at the south end, and looking straight down the Salinas Valley, which is home to all that lettuce and celery and spinach and broccoli.
And artichokes,
right, totally, right. Artichokes in Salinas Valley, and then out to the ocean, too. It's, I don't know how I get to keep being there, but I'm so lucky, right? It's just this beautiful landscape. And I got to, and it, the soil on the farm is not great soil, but I got to see how it has changed over 40 years of intensive organic farming. How putting compost and cover crops into the soil year after year has turned it into really nice, workable, supporting soil. And then I got to eat berries warm from the fields. I got to know in the farms that I had been at in Iowa, that the farmers that I knew well in Iowa didn't have really very many farm workers. They had college students or their own children sometimes. But not really farm laborers. But in this context in California, I really got to really know more about farm workers and know some farm workers that were associated with my field sites. And then I also got to know people from around the world coming to our program in intensive agriculture education. And so those are some of the places that I know, some of the things that have shaped how I see farms and gardens, and that that give me hope for changing a food system. And so what I want to do is I want to point out a few of the key challenges with the way our food system is now. I assume you know that we have some challenges with our food system. So I'm going to make sure that we kind of get those listed. And then I want to talk about what our food system could become, and that favorite word of mine, that agroecology word. And so as we do this, I just want to I want to have acknowledged these places. Okay, I want to acknowledge these places that you know, the places that have shaped me and my understanding of agriculture, and the people that manage them, because there's a lot of hard work going into getting us food, and then even the plants and animals, knowing that they are there too, and it's all that specificity that's going to drive us. And then I also want to acknowledge the scale of what we're talking about. So I want to do just, I won't make you do the math. I already did the math. Isn't that nice? I need a drink of water first. But I want to talk about scale, too, before we... So, because this is important, too, that it's not worth to think about as we think about changes. And I like to talk to my students about this because So in Iowa, I'm the same person I was. In Iowa, I was a radical leftist, and in Santa Cruz, I'm pretty much white bread conservative, even though I haven't changed. It's the context that changes. And so my students in Santa Cruz, they want to go out and they want to convert our whole school to feeding, to local eating off of our farm, okay? So we have some of you that are already more tuned into numbers. So we have a 20-acre farm on our campus. They want to feed our campus off of that farm. So here's a little bit of math. So we have 16,328 undergraduates. It's big, right? Not as big as some, but it's big. So if we were going to, we need about, on average, adults need somewhere between 2,000 to 2,500 calories, right? Mm-hmm. And then let's say that we were going to try to feed about 50% of those undergrads. Let's say that about half of them eating meals on campus. And let's see, that turns out then that gives us about 8,164 times 2,150. I'm going to use halfway between those. Oh, I did it with 2,150 even though 2,250. Oh, well, whoops. That's all right.
Go get skinny.
Yeah.
We're going to put them on a little bit of a diet. Exactly. Perfect, right? Okay. So they're on a mild diet, just a really mild one. And so that gives us, we're gonna need to feed that many people. We need 18,369,000 calories per day. Okay, to feed all these people. And we're just totally leaving aside nutrients. We don't care about nutrients for them. We just want to make sure they're still breathing and have bodily functions. So that's what we're going for. Okay, so I tell my students, so if we have, anybody know how many calories you have in a pound of black beans? We're just going to use black beans. We're going to feed everybody black beans. We don't care if they like them or not. That's what we're giving them.
Pretty dense.
What was that?
It's probably pretty dense calorie-wise. Yeah. Foods go, I would think.
Yeah, they're pretty yeah. dense. They're about 1,400 calories in a pound. Yeah, so pretty good. Wheat is also 1,400. Rice is 1,500, so about 1,400 calories in a pound of black beans. So for yield goals, you can look up yield goals to see what farmers would be trying to do. And for yield in California, for black beans, you would be looking somewhere between 1,800 to 2,400 pounds per acre. So we'll take 2,100 pounds per acre. Okay, so let's use our little 20-acre farm. I think it's actually slightly more than, it's a little bit more than that, but part of it is in orchards, so we're not going to take down the orchards to do this. And part of it is in housing for the people that come to live there and work there, so we're not going to take that away. So about the usable space we would have is about 20 acres. So if we have 20 acres, yeah, right, and we have 2,100 pounds then we're per acre, we're at 42,000 pounds of black beans. And then if we add in the calories from those, what we end up with is we have about 1.3 days of beans. If we're going to keep everyone alive we're going to keep half the undergraduates alive for
1.3
days.
The entire farm.
If we harvested it all at once.
Yeah.
Yep, in beans. Mm-hmm.
And that's all they get.
And that's all they get. That's all they're having. Yeah, they don't even get tortillas when they have this, right? They're just having beans. So, right, so it's like, thinking about the scale of what we're talking about, it's like, they're not going to be really simple answers. We're not just going to go and change everything tonight. Because if this is just my students, this is just half of my students on campus for 1.3 days on 20 acres, right? Do we have to think really about the size? What this food system is providing for us is so much, right? Because we're eating way more than black beans. And not everything is as nutrient-dense as beans. We're eating, because we have a variety of foods. Lettuce is really low nutrients, low calories, but it has other nutrients, especially if it's not just iceberg lettuce. So we're just thinking about really the scale of what we're talking about when we're talking about farming.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to rip that down and do one more. Yeah.
What do you do with the people who you just put out of work by growing your own crops?
Right, and we have to think about that too. That is a really important piece of it. Right, and with immigration stuff that's going on, part of the reason we have people working on farms who are migrant laborers is because other people don't want to do that work. Right.
Although I just heard on NPR, a celery grower in Southern California, this is a 100-year-old family farm.
Yeah.
He can't get workers any longer to cut the celery, and they're now paying $24 an hour to cut celery.
Wow.
And he can't get workers because the workers can make more money in landscaping.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, if they're being allowed to stay.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I should head down. I don't know that I'm making 25.
Yeah, no,
sorry. Almost sounds
holy.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Great. So, and then one other thing I want to mind. So I want to keep in mind landscape and the people, the real people that are doing this work. And I want to keep in mind the scale. And then I really want to keep in mind the intention of how we got to this situation that our food system is in today. So one of the things is that the intention is really, really actually really honorable and noble, right? That there was not of everybody in the food system, but some really key players. So there was a U.S. agronomist, Norman Borlaug, and he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1970 for work in really increasing cereal grain production, especially wheat in Mexico. And then he went on and did that also in India and Pakistan. He had been hired in 1944 to head wheat research, a big wheat research program funded in part by Rockefeller. And the goal was to make Mexico self-sufficient. Now, this is the kind of in grain production. We've lost that goal by now. But anyhow, but the fear in 1940, you know, what were we afraid of? If people were hungry in Mexico.
They'd become communists.
Yes, exactly. So we did not, this program was sponsored by the government and Rockefeller because we didn't want communists on our southern border. So that's the, like, dubious part of it. But Norman Borlaug, from what I've read of him, he was really about trying to make sure that people had enough to eat. And his team worked really hard. They developed wheat varieties that grew well. They grew well with increased water. They grew well with increased chemical fertilizer, and when they added those components, they doubled the yield. And Mexico was indeed self-sufficient. It took about 12 years, and they got there. And then he went to India and Pakistan from 63 to 65 when they were under threat of famine there. So Norman Borlaug had these really noble intentions. And I think other people in the food system have that have made some of these kind of push for these big changes too. That really good intention is there. So even though I think that has led us down some dubious roads, I do want to recognize that wasn't the intent, right? The intent was to make sure people had enough to eat. Which is, if we don't have enough to eat, that's it, right? That's really really basic human need. So what I want you to do next is I want you to draw out what goes in and out of an agricultural system, and I'll bring around pens. So you're thinking about what goes in and what comes out of an agricultural system. If you want, you can draw plants on there. Or whatever, however you'd like to do it, but what's going in and what's coming out in an agricultural system. So I'll give you a couple minutes to do this. You can do this in teams again. Cool. Think about Okay, so you all are doing a great job. You're really you're capturing so much in your lists and drawings. And so I want to do like really at the really simple level, and then you all are taking it to the next level. So we'll build from this and build up to where you are. But some of the basic things, just going into growing a crop, right? So there are a lot of those out there. Well, what are some of the things just first going into growing just and that was a good question too, a plant crop. So what are some of the things going in just to this part?
Seed.
Yeah, seed.
Sun.
Soil.
Sun.
Water.
Nutrients.
Water. Yep, nutrients. So that's generally chemical fertilizer is the most common. Sun, water, seed, fertilizer. What is the last thing I'm missing?
Soil.
Soil. Yep, the soil. You need the whole soil matrix here. What,
and the seed summarizes a lot, right? Because the seed's all like custom seed with.
Yep, so it's got genetics.
And it's also got protection from herbicides. And
yep. Yeah, right, yeah.
Which is covered by that.
Yeah, which is part of that, right?
Temperature control.
In an outside... Oh, yeah, well, that's true, too. Oh, right. Yes, especially, like, for fruit, right? So there's some have a form of temperature control. Depending on the production system.
Pesticides.
And pesticides. Yeah, pesticides and herbicides, yeah. So the general one then is pesticides, which includes herbicides, fungicides, insecticides, rodenticides. There's all kinds.
What's rodenticide?
Rodents.
Oh, rodents.
Yeah, there's like a whole, there's like a bigger list than I knew about. What was that?
Oh, I just said I'm rodent.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think we ought to put labor in there somewhere.
Yes, yeah. And labor. I agree.
And money.
Yeah.
Yes, right, because it's not free to farm, right?
We also added subsidies.
Yeah.
It's part of the system.
Yeah, and the subsidies affect this in a couple different ways. Sometimes they're for what your commodity is, that's price support for what you're producing. Sometimes there are hidden subsidies in fertilizers that keep energy prices low. So oil subsidies keep energy prices low, which makes making chemical fertilizer is really energy intensive, because nitrogen is we're surrounded by nitrogen. Like 78% of our atmosphere is nitrogen. We breathe it in and out all the time. There, I took a big whiff. I just took a bunch of nitrogen in, but then I just put a bunch of nitrogen back out, because this N2 gas, I can't do anything with. It surrounds us. But if I had no way of obtaining nitrogen from my environment, I would, even though it's like, I would die without input of nitrogen from food, even though I'm surrounded by it. It's like dying of thirst in a bowl of water, right? Or a pool of water. I just can't use it because it's everywhere around me. Not because it's everywhere around me. Even though it's everywhere around me, I can't use it. Legumes can use it. Some bacteria can use it. And we've also learned how to do this. So that nitrogen gas is two nitrogen. I think it's a triple bond.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yay. Two nitrogen atoms bound together in a triple bond, and it's really, really strong. So, another way you get it is lightning strikes. When lightning strikes, there's a little bit of nitrogen that's produced as that bolt goes through the atmosphere, down through the atmosphere. So it's a huge, huge energy use. So, what was that? Come down in rain?
Yeah.
It's in another form that the rain can pick it up and bring it down. Yeah. But we just generally can't access it. But the legumes, so beans and peas and all the native legumes, they can do it with the bacteria that are in living inside their roots, and then other bacteria, some other bacteria in the environment. and archaea. I now have to remember to start saying archaea and bacteria because they're now very different, but I have to keep learning too. When the Haber-Bosch process is like this, Haber-Bosch, through that process we figured out how to split apart that nitrogen, and that's how we get chemical fertilizer. And then the form that we put it on, it's we put it on as ammonia, or we put it on as sometimes other forms. But when it goes into the soil, then the plants can use that. Because the plants are the same as us. They can't, unless you're a legume, you're surrounded by all this nitrogen and same, you can't use it. So they have to get it from the soil, or they have to get it from the fertilizer. They have to get it from somewhere. So but it's only if we actually had to like incorporate the cost of oil into like in a kind of true way into the cost of fertilizer, we wouldn't be producing it in the same way, because we'd probably already learn to reduce, because it would be more expensive. Mm-hmm. So there's also subsidies in the water. Boy, in California, that's super obvious. Agriculture water is much cheaper than household water, and we should be more careful with it. It's also the chemical-based pesticides. It's in there too. So subsidies are in several of these places.
Yeah.
Mechanized labor, machinery.
Oh yeah.
Energy. Yeah.
Including mechanized. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we added transportation also.
Yeah. And so to
add
get it
all
off
levels.
The farm. Yeah. There's transportation just embedded in this whole system to get, and I don't know why, it's so great to just be alive and learn as you go, right? Like, why did it take me until last year to realize that, I had realized it, but to really think about, wow, all seed has to be raised in fields that are just like the same, so that then you can take that seed and put it in the ground. So the seed all has to get raised through this whole same big set of everything, right?
Yeah.
And
then
to get the seed to go back. And that seed has to be transported and that whole process. So I mean, this is just this one, like you said, this one little thing is really representing a lot more, even just to get to this, putting it in the ground. And then...
Well, water's kind of the same way, too, right? Because California organizes everything around water.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the costs of water go way beyond what it costs a farmer to put a well down. I mean, it's...
Yeah. One of the single biggest uses of energy in California, in the whole state of California, is... So, California's water, in kind of a nutshell, I don't know, that's California-ish, right? Okay, and so it rains more up here, right? And if this is LA, much less water, we know that, right? LA really shouldn't, it's not okay. I know, but there's a lot of people, right? And so what we do is we take the water, we've set this up over time, with a lot of energy and a lot of political energy. That was such a great way to say that, right? And we set it up so that we move the water where it falls down, and it also falls here along all the mountains. These are the Sierra along here. So it falls here as snow, and we capture it as it comes down. And we San Francisco, maybe it maybe looks green, but it depends on water from the Sierra too. It's getting its water. Santa Cruz, I can be a little smug from Santa Cruz because we have our own water supply. We're one of, like, literally, like, three places in the state that is not connected to this huge system. So we are really careful with water, because if our reservoir, we have one small reservoir, and if that's in trouble, our whole city's in trouble. So we're really on it because it's ours, right? But otherwise, water is flowing. It's going here. It's going down. Oops, yeah, this way, down into agriculture. And then here is L.A. And if you've ever driven down I-5 to L.A., just before you get there, there's one last thing you have to do.
Grapevine.
Yeah, you have to go up this huge mountain. Well, not huge, but a pretty substantial hill. And then you've got to drop into the city. So one thing I like to do in one of my classes is make students carry a carboy, like a 25 liter carboy of water, and like walk it down and back. And water, because water is heavy. Water is heavy stuff. So even though this whole system is really passive, that most of this is just running by gravity, it's pumped up several feet right here at the delta. This is at Sacramento. There's a big delta here. And it's pumped up a little bit, and then it passively runs. Well, that's great for a long way, but by the time it hits LA, it needs a boost over this mountain. And this right here, boosting up this water to get it over the hill to come down into LA and everything else that's down here, this is a huge, one of the biggest uses of energy in the state, is to lift all that water up this mountain. So, like, one of the biggest, like, single one place using a big amount of energy is right there. Yeah, so that's, so the water represents a lot of other things, too, that aren't reflected in it. Yeah.
You need time.
What was that?
You need time.
Oh, time. You do also need time. Right. Yeah. Like if our campus had, if the food was cut off and we had half the undergraduates up there, we couldn't feed them beans tomorrow because we'd have to grow all those 1.3 days of black beans for them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You also have sales or marketing costs. You can grow it, but you have to be able to sell it.
That's true. So transportation and sales out here. Yeah. It's got to get to people.
Appropriate weather.
Yeah, temperature control, or you need, which is a really big deal. As climate is changing and shifting, we need to really be thinking about how we adapt to that. There is a grower, he's a great grower. Frog Hollow peaches are some of my favorite peaches. Does anybody know Frog Hollow peaches?
Yeah.
Gosh, they're so good. And Farmer Al, he's great. And he has housing for his workers. It's great all around. It's Frog Hollow. You can feel happy when you eat those peaches. They're a good thing. And I was talking with him in January, and he was saying how his cherry, things that he's grown for a long time on his farm, which is just up north of Sacramento a little bit, north and, yeah, it's inland and up just a little bit, I think is right where it is. And he, things that he's grown for a long time, he is having to really think about changing. So he's grown cherries and peaches and apricots and plums for a long time. He is now, his cherries are about, he's getting he said, he's getting a profit about 1 in 6 years off his cherries. You can't do that for very long. Not very long at all. And so he's now planting other things for the first time. He's now planting avocados to see how they'll do. He's now planting citrus. He's planting things that are going to be able to handle warmer weather. Because this shift, the cherries to for appropriate weather, one of the things you need for fruit, for temperate fruit trees, apples, cherries, plums, pears, things like that, you need chill hours. They have to have a particular number of chill hours. It tells them that it's been cold enough, long enough for them to wake up and set fruit. It's an ecological adaptation, right? If you woke up too early every year and you started blooming in the winter, then your buds are going to get knocked off and your developing fruit's going to get knocked off and you just won't make it. So that line will be gone. So ecologically, they're adapted to be signaled that it's been cold enough, long enough, that now it's spring, now they can flower and fruit and do all the things they need to do. So as those chill hours decrease, and this year, it was like a student studying for an exam. It's really fun because I teach climate and agriculture in winter quarter. And so you can count, you can see the chill hours. You can go on to UC Davis has, through extension, you can look and see There's a fruit and nut chill hour calculator. So you can go and look for your local weather station, what's your current number of chill hours? And you know, okay, my apples generally need about 1,000 chill hours. So what are we at today? And they start. You start on November 1st, and you count up through the end of February. And it's every hour under 45 degrees. So you say, wow, how many hours has it been under 45 degrees? And then you see them add up. Well, this year, the way they added up was like, it was like, if there's a graph, and this is number of hours, and this is date. So in November, there's their low, and then December came along, and they were low, and January came along, and they were low, and so there's February. I said the end of February, oh, so this is 1st of March. They were like, oh, we probably should have some chill hours. And so it did that. Like, all the chill hours for the year were, well, I mean, there were little spikes. But then it was like, whoa. They're like, oh, the exam's here. We better actually study. We better get all our chill hours in like 2 weeks. And we have this really weird cold end of February into early March. And the fruit trees had already been, like, starting to wake up here because they were, well, they didn't even know what they were doing. They were all confused because the signals were all weird. But they were, by the time it hits March, there's already, because not only are they dealing with chill hours, but they're also like daylight sensitive. So they're like getting these cues about daylight, and they're like, oh, do we wake up? Do we go back to bed for a bit? They're all out of whack, yeah.
Another cost, trade tariffs are getting a lot of attention these days, and that's sort of an indirect cost to farmers.
Tariffs. Yeah, tariffs. I mean, should we put them right by subsidies? Oh, is it one R or two?
Double F.
Okay. Yeah, right. And so that affects the whole system on top of that.
We probably should then add also immigration policies.
Yep. Yep. Right. Yep.
With labor stuff.
Yeah, that's labor, I guess.
Yeah, immigration policies, right. Yeah, yeah.
You need peace because there's not very much food being grown in Syria or Afghanistan right now.
Yeah, right. And so thinking out beyond this, where it's, the political climate, where does that go? So there's temperature control, there's also political climate. Yeah. Yeah, there are other examples of that too. I mean, even, Lebanon and Syria had, even just from some big agriculture they had back in the earlier part of last century, was destroyed and had to be rebuilt in wars at that time too. But right, it is really hard to think about that. Oh, you are all so smart. Yeah. So all of these together, right? So we're growing a lot of food, but to do this, there are some costs, right? And you already know a lot about these costs already, but let's see. Oh, yeah, no, this is the page I want. I'm going to try to enumerate them a little bit swiftly. Is that all right?
Sure.
Okay, just so you have kind of have a whole list of them. But great. I love that you are all so interactive. I really do. Okay. So here's kind of this is the current state, sort of. Nail right through it. Maybe that's symbolic. I don't know. Okay, and so basically what we're doing when we do this is we're basically treating these systems as ultimately as factories, right? That we're putting water in, and we're putting seed in, we're putting fertilizer in, we're putting labor in, and the mechanics, and then we try to keep the politics good around it, and then we get out food and profit is what we're trying to do, right? And so here are some of the costs of this kind of production that we've been doing. So one is, this is costs of the industrial model. And recognizing, like I said, right? Recognizing that I eat because of that system right now, right? That what I feed myself, what I feed my children is this. It comes from this. So recognizing that we eat well because this is how we do it right now. Right. So I just want to make sure that that's out there. Okay. Well, I critique it. Okay. Right. So one of the things is we have reduced genetic diversity. Like, how many apple varieties can we name? Although, we have a few plants in here. We have a few people that know apples. But still, like...
Honeycrisp,
John Bull,
Fuji,
Red
Delicious,
Sagintosh, Rayburn, John Bull,
Golden
Yellow.
What's the new one?
Jazz.
We got Honeycrisp.
Kings.
Cosmic Crisp. I don't know Cosmic Crisp.
That's a new one.
Pippins. Okay.
Pink Lady.
What was that?
Pink Lady.
Oh, yeah, Pink Ladies.
Rosalind.
Ooh, I don't know Rosalind yet. Okay, so we're at 13. Granny Smith, 14. Ooh, Ambrosia. Ooh, we're doing really well. This is pretty good. 15 is really good.
That's awesome.
We got Red and Golden.
No,
Cameo? Oh, Cameo. Yeah, right.
Zestar, did you get that?
Zestar, no. Oh, I didn't get Zestar.
New
one. Ooh.
Minnesota.
Ooh. Yeah. Oh, Macintosh. Oh, yeah. How can we forget Macintosh? Okay, 18. UCSC has the farm and garden. So one of our gardens is the Chadwick Garden. It was the first garden on campus. It's about 50 years old now. And it's on a hillside. The eccentric Shakespearean actor that was brought in to do the French Market Garden style garden on the hillside. He purposely picked this awful hillside with terrible soil that had been scraped and had like equipment on it for a long time. He purposely chose that site to start the first garden, the first food producing garden at UCSC, because he wanted to show that you could change terrible soil into great soil. And he did. This awful, horrible soil, you can now put your arm just right into these beds, like probably almost up to my elbow. It's unbelievable, beautiful soil. And it was, when I am trying to install equipment, not in the beds, but the, down at the farm, which is the same, actually slightly better to begin with soil, in the summer I use a pickaxe to try to, once I'm down past the first few inches, I'm like trying to chip it out with anything I can find that'll, because the first foot or so down the farm is great, but below that it's horrible. And so that this is something that you can just put your arm in and it's dark and beautiful. It's nothing like the surrounding. But so that garden is managed by this guy, Oren Martin, who loves fruit trees. He has, I think, 123 varieties of fruit trees in that garden. And so there's all this diversity that through this model we lose. So even though I'm really impressed that we're at 18, we're doing like stellar. But there's all this other diversity that we aren't capturing through our industrial model. And that's the same across all different kinds of crops. That it's less than it could be. That just concerns me, especially with the changing climate, because we don't know what will come. We don't know how pests will change. We don't know how weeds will change. We don't know how the crops will be responding to this. And so the more diversity we have in our food system in lots of ways, but including genetic diversity, the better.
The system kind of rewards the development of qualities in food that really aren't about food, but are about durability for storage and for transportation.
Mm-hmm.
I had a cousin who worked for Hunt Wesson Quality Control, and he was telling me about these great tomatoes they had developed. He said, you could take them, throw them against a wall, and it wouldn't break. He said, they didn't taste very good, though.
So then you go in and add all the other things,
right?
In Iowa, I had an original Red Delicious. Now, okay, some people, I'm kind of an apple snob, it turns out. I have my faults. That is definitely one of my faults. I'm pretty snobby about apples. So my, some people love Red Delicious, and I'll recognize that. You're welcome to that opinion. I don't love Red Delicious. Okay. There's two of us, okay. So, because the way they are now, they are shiny and red, and they stack well, and they keep for a long time. But in Iowa, I had one of the early Red Delicious before the line had just been kind of brought in further and further, and it was really a good apple. I couldn't believe it was a Red Delicious because it was really a really tasty apple. And so, yeah, you're right. They're bred for all these other things, but the actual foodness of them is the foodness is not.
It's a good word.
Yeah. The foodness of them is not necessarily one of them. Yeah.
So I know Davis has a huge bank of wine. Actually,
oh,
not wine,
yeah.
Of grape.
Great stock.
Yeah, thank you. So do we have anything similar like that for the other seeds and whatnot?
Some of them we do, and some of them we have to remake that. Mm-hmm. So it depends. Prince Charles is really into apples. Mm-hmm. Turns out too. I don't know why, but he is. So he's really into apple diversity. So he has a farm with a lot of that diversity. And then there are a few places around. There's a great guy up in Nevada City down in California that he's gone around and found old apple and pear and some other fruiting varieties that were left over from when miners were there,
right.
From when it was really a mining community. And he's taking scion, he's taking the cuttings off of those and growing those out to really
Santa
do that.
Santa Cruz have anything like that?
Does Santa Cruz have? I mean, we have the garden, but we don't have a purposeful seed library. We have a small seed library run by students on campus, but it's it varies with the management of the current management of the students. Just it's hard, things run by students is hard because you have turnover and varying levels of commitment to the project. Right?
Sure.
Yeah, but there's and so it depends on the crop. In some places, there's more, and in some places, there's much less. And then there's some great groups. There's a group called Seed Savers Exchange that's trying to, like, make sure that they are getting different, they're maintaining diversity. Oh, there's a huge, what's his name?
Colorado State, isn't it?
Colorado State? Do they have one, too?
I thought they did.
That could be. Yeah. There's one in Russia, too. There's a really important seed library in Russia.
There's a big one in Norway.
Yeah. Oh, in the Norway. Yep.
I think it melted or something, and there was a big problem.
Threat,
oh,
right.
Okay.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
And then there's all these things with seed libraries. So seeds. Do you know? This is one of my favorite. This is another favorite thing. My seeds are alive.
Mm-hmm.
So they respire. They just like us. Because they're not photosynthesizing. So they take in oxygen and they release carbon dioxide. It's just like they're sleeping, so they're doing it at a very slow rate. They're respiring at a very slow rate. So they're using up their stored carbohydrates. That's why they have carbohydrates. Seeds don't have carbohydrates for us. They have it for themselves to grow. That's the whole point of being a seed. And so they take in oxygen, they use that to combust the carbohydrates and release carbon dioxide. So that's kind of one way one indicator in a lab you can use for seed. If your seed is alive, is you can measure carbon dioxide respiration from it. So seeds are finite. So when you have seed libraries, it also means that you have to have places to grow out your seed and collect it and put back fresh stock over time. So even where it's cold in Norway, you can't keep it forever. Keeping it cold makes them respire at a slower rate. But you still have to replenish it. Isn't that so amazing?
Mm.
Boy, that was another one of those things.
Why can't they be frozen?
Some of them can, and some of them don't like it as much. But some of them can. But it'll still, freezing conditions will still, they'll get dehydrated over time, or you're still dealing with a live thing that's frozen. Yeah. Another thing is we've got a lot of soil erosion. So we're talking about billions of tons of topsoil around the world.
What about soil depletion?
And soil depletion. Yeah.
Okay.
So actual loss of it, and that's true. And decreasing the quality of it in a variety of ways. Yeah. And to get a good 1 inch of topsoil... That's 1,000 years in an inch of topsoil.
Really?
Mm. So it's not, it's a slowly renewable resource. Yeah, you really need time, right? Time
so
is.
So, how did your Frenchman get 4 feet or whatever it was?
Yeah, so he already, well, he was a British Shakespearean actor, but using French intensive methods, yes. So he's, he was hurrying that process along a little bit by adding compost and cover crops in big quantities. But then he also, but he wasn't actually building the soil particles themselves too. He already had a starting point. So to really transform like original content into soil takes 1,000 years. So if you if it blows off, if you deplete, if the quality is not great, you can work with that. If it blow, for the most part, except salinity is a big problem. If you increase the salinity of your soil, that takes a lot of water to change. But if you are losing your soil off the site, that's like good luck, because yeah, that's a problem, right? The third is, like we've been talking about, overuse of water. So we have a groundwater hydrologist in our room right here. This is really in the same kind of way we're mining our groundwater. Well, I guess not in Louisiana, right? You're not mining the groundwater so much, because there's lots of groundwater in Louisiana.
Yes and no.
Oh.
How we develop it and use it.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Such as in Baton Rouge. Well, I'll just, if you got time, I'll just explain. Going through the city is a geologic fault. On one side it's salt water, and on the other side it's fresh water.
Uh-huh.
Because the fault is holding back the water that's flowing toward the sea.
Uh-huh.
And as the area develops, population. We would like, I say we, would like them to start using the Mississippi River like the industries do,
uh-huh.
rather than bringing this, using, overusing the fresh groundwater, which gets low enough, the salt water will move in there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because... I mean, this is going to be highly oversimplified, so forgive me, right? But, so, like, this is what we're experiencing right now in California, too. So here's the ocean. That's our Monterey Bay. And so this is happening in Watsonville, just south of Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz's geology is really different. But down in the lower part of Monterey, or the mid part of Monterey Bay. So here's the ocean, and here's the soil. And here are all these crops growing. Crops. Well, it looks like a butterfly, but you know, it's a plant of some kind. So there are crops growing here, and it turns out that this is what I try to make my freshwater ecology students see: that there is water all here in the soil, and that this fresh water is holding that ocean water back. So if you put in a big straw, you guys drew a great straw over there, and you're taking this groundwater up to water these plants, well, over time, if this is too great of a change, that ocean water is going to be able to push in. And then you're going to have salt water in your groundwater. Right? Is that, that's oversimplified, but...
The only thing that you probably need to say is that...
Yeah.
That fresh water does not flow underneath the salt water unless it's got what we call a head.
Yes.
Unless the fresh water is higher, that gives it the pressure to move that way.
Yeah, so maybe I should draw my ocean like down here.
But with rising ocean levels, that's a threat to that.
Yes, and rising ocean levels. And like I said, when you look down Monterey Bay, you can see there's the Salinas Valley, and then there are the mountains down. And so this is, it looks, on a cloudy day, you can't even see that there's any, or on most days, you can't even see there's land here. The Salinas Valley is flat, because that was where a river was coming out to the ocean. right? And so this is if yeah, exactly as you're saying, is that water, as that ocean level rises, it's going to push in there.
On roughly the same process, the whole LA basin, Orange County, Los Angeles County, all that area, they constantly monitor the groundwater to make sure that they don't have too much saltwater intrusion into the basin. And they have wells, and they can pump water down to counteract the pressure if they have to. I mean, it's just...
Well, you also have the delta around San Francisco.
Yeah.
And that's a big concern because of the...
Yep.
The ocean, the salt water.
Yep. And then even in other places, so the Ogallala Aquifer runs under this huge portion of the central U.S. It supports 20% of our corn and wheat, I think, and in our country. So they're not going to have saltwater intrusion, but they're going to have no water, which is also a bad situation.
And they're making rivers disappear. They literally... federal court orders stopped Nebraska farmers from pumping out the Ogallala Aquifer to the extent they were, because the Republican River, which is the border between Nebraska and Kansas, was literally disappearing. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's just
The ground. I mean, we just have treated groundwater like it's this endless supply too, right? But it's not. It's finite too. It's in some cases we're using basically fossil water. We're using it at a rate that we can't replenish it fast enough. We're using topsoil at that rate. We're using water at that rate. We're using the fossil fuels at that rate, right?
Well, I've read that there's a lot of work going on right now to produce plants that can tolerate salt water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people are working on...
So promising thing we're looking at?
Well... You know, if it, I don't know, because it takes a long time to breed novelty into plants like that, right? And so how long will that process take?
Quite a while, if it's the evolutionary process.
There was actually a process that I was at a lecture, they were talking about bathing seeds in this certain kind of a fungi sort of bath, and that would make the seeds resistant to drought and water. Saltwater intrusion and heat as well.
Wow.
And the problem was is it couldn't be patented, so the company didn't want to take it to market.
Oh.
Just FYI.
There you go.
But are those all kind of like Band-Aid fixes to what is essentially a much larger systemic problem?
Yeah. I think that's, you know, so at first when I heard about, like, GMOs, I was really kind of worried about, like, what are we eating and, you know, what's that going to do in our bodies and stuff. That's really much less of a concern for me now. What I don't like is all the time that's put into a very few plants. A lot of time and resources put into a very few things that is not encouraging that diversity, which to me, the diversity seems like, that's like it's like not having anything left in your bank account, just like... going only one direction and not relying on something bigger to support you, or not even just a bank account, but like having, I don't know, putting all your money under the mattress and then your house burns up. And then what? Oh, that may be really, that was actually pretty good. I love it when my analogies actually work. I make up analogies all the time and sometimes they're terrible. But that one, like, if our house is literally burning up, right, if our planet is warming and then there goes our mattress. So, yeah. There's lots of fertilizer into the environment. This, here's another Louisiana story, right, but this isn't actually Louisiana's fault. This is all the Midwest's fault, that all the nitrogen coming down the Mississippi River, it leads to a growth of algae. The algae are eaten by zooplankton. And when the zooplankton die, they start decomposing, and it's the decomposing that consumes all this carbon dioxide, or consumes all the oxygen out of the water, so you get dead zones. But Minnesota and Iowa, and all the,
Nebraska.
In Illinois, Nebraska, all
Kansas.
In Kansas, yeah, all the states up there that are feeding into the Mississippi. So you're off the hook for this. Okay. And the way that we put on chemical fertilizer right now, plants, they only can take up 30 to 50% of the nitrogen we put on. So we always have to put on more than they are actually going to use, because they just they're just inefficient. I guess we could be upset with the plants because they're not perfectly efficient with the fertilizer we give them. And then there's, like we've been talking about, energy use, greenhouse gas emissions, GHG for greenhouse gas emissions in multiple ways. And another one just is loss of on-farm biodiversity. So if we remove everything from our fields except the crop, then we lose that land as land for other organisms. And again, it's like if we don't even know, us humans, it just feels like we just don't know what we're doing all the time, right? It's like, okay, so what is on there that ends up being key to some other process that we can't even see is happening, right? So that's what concerns me.
Kind of like the milkweed eliminating,
yes.
Milkweed eliminates the monarch butterflies because they require that.
Yes, they require it for, they lay their eggs on it and their mm-hmm. larvae eat it. And so that's like one, and it's great that it's monarchs because they're so beautiful and charismatic, right? So what are all the little uncharismatic things that we don't even know that we're displacing or losing? Yeah. Whew. Okay. So what I want to tell, then there are all the social effects. So these are like some of the environmental effects. But then there are the social effects too. We're gonna have to stay till 7. Just kidding. Well, just I'm gonna list a couple of the social ones and then just tell you briefly about agroecosystems, and then I'll tell you to go look at all these things over here over time because I think they're great. So social issues. One is vertical integration. So vertical integration is just that fewer and fewer companies own more and more parts of the food system. The part that they don't own is the work by the farmers. So farmers buy the seeds from companies. They do all the farm labor because that's where the risk and the weather is. The weather, the seed companies, they can't control the weather. So that you get the seeds, you plant them, then you sell basically back to the same companies. You sell the same back to them for processing, for milling, and then into animal feed or into human food, and then the byproducts come to us as human food that they've transported. So one company will own basically from the seed to the plate, and through different brands associated with that. And sometimes they're also selling you, sometimes it's the same companies that are selling you the chemicals. So same companies will be either subsidiaries or working together, but they'll be selling you the fertilizer or the herbicides that'll go into that same system. And this isn't totally across the board. It's not perfect, but it's happening. But then there's just that piece of the risk for the farmer. So vertical integration, which again, to me, we are in some cases literally putting all our eggs in one basket, right? Well, or one shopping basket. So it's just thinking about that loss of diversity in the companies. That always just makes me nervous. Any loss of diversity. Maybe I should just make a pin. This loss of diversity makes me nervous or something. I don't know. The effects on the farmers to be able to stay or their children to want to stay. So rural migration, loss of people from rural communities. Food deserts. We have all this food, but we have places that where people can't get access to healthy food. Even accounting for differences culturally in what people might appreciate as healthy food, but still, even with that, thinking about some places people can't get good fresh food. Food safety. Do you remember there was the spinach outbreak of 2007? There's been salmonella outbreaks in eggs because the bacteria are stoked. We've set up a great food system for bacteria. For the spinach outbreak, it was one feral pig wandering through one farm in California, and then the spinach was harvested, and then it goes into big vats. It's mixed all together, and then it's sealed in plastic bags. The bacteria just are like, thank you so much, and then it's distributed across the country, and then all these people get sick because it's coming from one place. And same, the salmonella outbreak was, I think, an Iowa farm, right? Or Iowa. Yeah, it was Iowa farm, and these eggs going around the country. So it's with that consolidation, then these food outbreaks are more likely. I overheard a different farmer saying, you know, if I have an E. coli outbreak on my farm, at least it's going to be like 70 people who are sick and not like hundreds or thousands of people getting sick. And I'll be able to know who they all are to degree.
Well, romaine's the last one.
Oh, right, and romaine. Yeah.
Melons was the last one.
Oh, melons?
Recently.
Oh, I missed the melons. I remember the romaine, we were supposed to eat romaine for like weeks. And then farm worker health. So in addition to these books, a really great book on farm workers is called Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies by, he was an anthropology student at Berkeley and a medical student at the same time, and he went and followed farmers, Oaxacan farmers. He went and picked corn with them in Mexico and then went and he tried to cross the border with them. He got caught. He cried. He went up and he picked berries with them, strawberries, and I think primarily strawberries in Skagit Valley and then also down in California, and just really tried to understand what these Oaxacan migrants are dealing with. So it's a really stellar book. And so what I really want to do ultimately is take all of this and re-examine these systems. So if we, instead of using an industrial model, if we think about this as an ecosystem, then we think about it in a slightly different way, right? That we think about everything that needs to go in, but we also start to think about, it needs the same things, it needs sunlight, the plants still need nutrients, this plant still need water. But if we think about it in this ecosystem kind of way, we really start to see these as producing other things. That if you count getting green space as one of the other benefits, is much more into this than we are. They really value their agricultural landscape in a different way than we do, that we would maybe do well to learn from. Thinking about green space, and you can camp, this is secondhand knowledge, but you can camp on farms in Norway and other places. Does anybody know that for sure?
Yeah.
I think that.
Yeah, that's what's it called?
Agro-tourism.
Yeah.
It's the right of every man, every person, to go and walk in the countryside and even pick the berries, the lingonberries.
Wow. Yeah.
That's not going to make
it's
it.
It's in the Constitution. Well, that's true. They're wild berries.
And if you change your approach, there's a great farmer in Minnesota that he says that he wants not a drop of water to leave his farm without cycling through his farm on the way. He grows in a conservation agriculture practice. I can talk to you about that more after if you're interested. But he is trying to make sure that no water is leaving his farm carrying nutrients, that the nutrients have stayed with the crops, the water going is clean. So he is cleaning water as it's going through his farm. There's carbon dioxide capture. Instead of losing the soil itself or losing the quality of the soil, we can the soil that is dark and rich, the soil that's building at the Chadwick Garden, that is capturing carbon. So there are some scientists that are really looking at how much potentially could we capture as part of sustainable farming practices. There's a lot of debate around this. It's not like we should do this is the only thing, I think, but it is one potential way if we can really treat these soils really more in an ecosystem way, if we think about the whole farm as an ecosystem, and the habitat for other species. And then because humans are part of the system, good employment, like honorable employment, employment that makes space for creativity, that's respected. I was really frustrated to see one time my husband is, he works with computers, that he had a computer magazine. It showed a farmer in a white male farmer in overalls with a bucket with the world in the bucket. And it was basically the message of the ad was, if this poor dumb farmer can understand the internet, then you can too. Right? It was like basically like if this guy gets it, then everybody can. What? That's like so wrong. Farming needs so much knowledge and then just unbelievable amount of chemistry and biology, right? And hydrology, all these things they have to know. So good, honorable employment for the work and and treating farm workers as the skilled labor force that they are. There's another great book, The American Way of Eating, where there's a young white woman who goes out and does some different jobs in the food system. But basically, she cannot keep up in any way with the skilled migrant labor force. They're so good at what they do, and she can't keep up with them at all. And livable wages, right? Mm-hmm. So these are all these things that we want. If we can think of this as having cycles, so like Matt was saying, there's all this waste output. So instead of waste, we're getting the water to cycle through. We're figuring out ways to get nutrients into the soil that are also going to build our ability to capture carbon. And actually, the more organic matter in your soil, the more water you will retain in your soil too. So you'll have better water holding capacity, so your plants won't be so dependent on outside water. So there's all these things that if we think about this as a system, an agroecosystem, then it changes then how we're going to be interacting with it. Incorporating waste. Yeah, and then it'll help us adapt as our climate is changing.
The books you listed up there, are they listed on the book list that was mentioned?
Nope, those two aren't. So the ones that I have with me, this is a great one, and I'll do more from this one on Friday. Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming by Paul Hawken. So the guy, one of the two founders of Smith & Hawken Gardening Supplies, right? He's he kind of led a team that looked at 100 different potential solutions to climate change. They might have looked at more than that and tried to rank them. Food is things related to food. I think three or four of the top 10 are food related. So things that we should do, they're in there. So that's a great book, Resilient Agriculture. So this is thinking about climate change in relation to this. This is it has some of the really basic kind of like understanding what could be happening, and then it also has stories from farmers who are doing alternative practices. That's the other important thing, sorry, that brings it all the way back to here. And then I will really let us go. We're only 4 minutes over. We'll go in just moments. That it's also place-based. So what works in one place will be appropriate for that place. And it's not just place, it's not just like physical location, but it's culture. It's the plants being adapted or the livestock being adapted to that place. It's this whole set of things that we should think about, right? So place-based. This is letters to a young farmer. So farmers writing as if they're writing to future farmers, because the age of our farmers is growing. Our average farmer age is growing. So we need to find ways to be bringing young people back into farming. This I really love for thinking about this. This is deeply rooted. This is stories of three different farmers, well, two farmers and one farming family, a black dairyman in Texas, a Latino, but his story is more than that, but I won't give it away, cattle rancher in New Mexico, and then a family growing grains and vegetables for seed in North Dakota. The writing in here is stellar. It reads like a novel, not like a novel, but I mean, it's super interesting reading.
Could you repeat the title?
Deeply Rooted.
And the author?
Is Lisa M. Hamilton. This is one of my favorites. And yeah, those are the four that I recommend, plus both of these I really enjoy too. The American Way of Eating and Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies. Mm-hmm. Woo! All right, that was kind of a lot right there at the end, but thanks for hanging in there through it. And... So sorry we didn't get into some of the more hopeful parts, but I think there's a lot of hope out there, really, that there are people that are concerned about this and people that are working on this, and we're just gonna have to work on it and figure it out.